Shobo Genzo, Kie Sanbo, and we left off last week talking about the Kano Doko, the sympathetic resonance between sentient beings and Buddhas, we could say. This is the third paragraph from the top. The act, or the literally the merit of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is achieved through mutual affinity and interaction. That's Kano Doko in Japanese. Suzuki Roshi found a place where he translates Kano Doko as responsive communion, or later he says mutual communion. So that's pretty good, I think. Kan is like this intuition or perception, and maybe the implying the request side or the inquiry side, and O in Japanese is response. So it's has a quality of inquiry and response. This asking and being answered, maybe. Hi, Helen.
I wrote down mystical communion.
Yeah, mystical communion. We could say that too.
Is the Doko, is any part of that the same as Dokusan?
No. It's Do is
way.
Way, yeah. And Dokusan is actually Doku is the character, which means actually like alone. And San is like meeting, so Dokusan is like meeting alone, which maybe as compared to where we have like group meetings like this, it's a one-on-one meeting, but it has that nice double meaning of it seems like there's two people meeting, but it's actually meeting alone. There's actually like it's like being one person. You can interpret it that way. And this doko is, the way, and ko is like crossing or joining. And, or communing, intersecting, communicating, exchanging. So, like the way of exchange. So, kind of this perception and response. The way of exchange would be kind of a really literal translation of kan o do ko, but hard to, you know, translate in a kind of concise way. So all these terms like mystical just means kind of like inconceivable spiritual communion, right? Mystical communion, sympathetic resonance is a nice one, I think. And Suzuki Roshi's responsive communion or mutual communion, and that's how taking refuge in the three treasures comes to be. So
it's the third paragraph.
I think it implies it's not so much something that we have to just do from our own power, and it's not something that just like magically comes to us through awakened mind of Buddha. It's like the meeting of the sentient being, the limited sentient being, and the limited sentient being's true Buddha nature. We could say in that meeting, which in a way is always happening, but when we really realize that meeting, that communion, then we naturally take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Or refuge happens, relying on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha naturally manifests in that sympathetic resonance between sentient beings and Buddhas. And then Dogen says, whether you're in a deva realm, a human realm, a hell realm, a demon realm, actually that demon there has the key of gaki, so maybe referring to like the hungry ghost realm, which is usually one of the six realms, an animal realm, all these realms of sentient beings, and when you have this mutual affinity interaction, when you have this sympathetic resonance with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you invariably or inevitably take refuge in them. So it's implying it's not even just a human thing. Or however we think of these six realms, literally or psychologically, whatever kind of state we're in, this mutual resonance is possible. That's how I would hear it. Like in a hell realm, it were really, really like at the end of a rope, like so totally depressed or angry and so far from our true nature, it seems. Still, in that openness, or request or opening to Buddha, the refuge can happen. I think it's a very positive statement. In any situation, this is possible. Taking refuge in the three treasures, Dogen says, you nurture yourself wherever you are, birth after birth, we could say life after life, world after world. You accumulate merit, assemble virtue, and attain unsurpassable complete enlightenment. Even if you're misled by unwholesome friends, obstructed by demons, cut off from your wholesome roots, and become an Ichantika, in the end, you will regain your wholesome roots and increase merit. The power of taking refuge, or the merit and virtue of taking refuge in the three treasures will never decay. So, Ichantika is this term that means like someone who's done so much harm in their life that they're cut off from Buddha, like permanently. So this sounds like horrible, it sounds a little like, it's not the kind of thing we like to hear. We think of like, and Dogen himself said, well, all these beings in these six realms and hell realms can open to Buddha. So,
isn't it also somebody who doesn't believe in Buddha?
Yeah.
Somebody who doesn't believe in Buddha?
Well, it's actually worse than that. I think it's defined as like these extremely like heinous actions. They sometimes say like the five actions that that are like beyond bad. They're like killing your parents, yeah, or killing a Buddha, or even like injuring like an arhat, and I forget what the other two are. I think maybe even like causing like a major like rift or schism in the Sangha is in this category too. Ooh. It's kind of scary. Like killing your parents? Because the Sangha is so, so precious, we don't want to like mess it up.
I thought that causing a rift was the worst.
Yeah. So it's in this category of something really bad. And anyway, there were these teachings of Ichantikas are like, they've almost like, they have no Buddha nature. They've like, their Buddha nature is like extinguished. There were these teachings, right? But then there's other teachings that came after that idea that quickly, found a problem with that idea and said, no, there's no such thing as somebody who loses their Buddha nature, no matter how bad. And that's, I think, the spirit of the Mahayana, is like you can't ever cut off these wholesome seeds of awakening. You can obscure them like heavy doodly. Many, many layers of just like, we're so removed from them. But that's the beauty of the Buddha nature teachings, is that it's, no matter how obscured it is, it's always possible to rediscover it, because it's actually reality. You can't cut off reality. So there was this debate about Ichantikas, and here Dogen seems to be taking the side, right, of the positive side, is even if you are an Ichantika, If you have refuge in the Buddha, you will in the end regain your wholesome roots. The Let's leave it at that. The power, the merit and virtue of taking refuge is so great. And Dogen then says, to take refuge in the three treasures, whether at the time of the Tathagata or after the Tathagata's parinirvana, like when the Buddha was alive or all the time afterwards, fill yourself with pure trust, put your hands together in gassho, bow or lower your head and recite in this way. And this is from one of the Chanyuan Chingwei, one of the old Zen collections of monastic ceremonies and so on. So, and we still have verses like this. This is a little bit different translation from our ordination ceremonies, but it's similar. We say, I, so-and-so, from this body, through the attainment of a Buddha body, take refuge in Buddha, take refuge in Dharma, take refuge in Sangha. So in our current ordinations, I think it's after we recite the three treasures, the preceptor says, from now on, in this present body, even after realizing the Buddha body, will you continue this truthful practice? Yes, I will. So it's another variation on this theme.
So is he saying, is he referring to this in the context of taking the precepts, or is he referring to it, or is this the kind of vow anyone can take at any time?
I think either one. The quote seems to come from actually a precept ceremony, like either a Jukai ceremony or a priest ordination ceremony. Dogen often, like, he'll do this thing when he gets a theme, like he's writing an essay on taking refuge in the three treasures, so he'll just go through all his books, it looks like, that refer to the three treasures and have references to them and then quotes them and then kind of like comments on them a little bit. So it seems like, oh, I remember in the Chanyuan Chingwei, there's this reference to taking refuge, and it's maybe he quotes it because it defines them in this way. So we do it three times, right? Just like we do every morning, there's this thing of three times reciting to keep, in case we're distracted, the first two. So the next one, it kind of defines them. I take refuge in Buddha, the most revered of those with 2 feet. I think translated as the best among bipeds. And, you know, I don't really know why they talk that way. Maybe we could say humans. There's not that many two-legged creatures, right? The best among humans is maybe the meaning.
Those with 2 feet tall.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at the Chinese, I've never heard this. I've seen it translated many times as among the two-leggeds or bipeds. But the Chinese for foot also means sufficient. It's like a totally different meaning, right? But that same character means sufficient. It's actually on the donation box. The character on the lower left, carved in there.
Just this is enough.
Yeah, and it literally is sufficient. Yeah, enough or sufficient. And also means foot, right? And then both. Two can also mean, well, yeah, there's two. So, like, you could say the two are sufficient, and maybe referring to these lists of, like, the accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom, or the Dharma body and the form body, you know, all these different lists of two that are totally complete in Buddhas. It might be a little word play there in Chinese, but I'm not sure. But the Buddha is the most revered or honored among the two-leggeds. Maybe, the elephants is the most honored among the four-legged. I don't know. I take refuge in Dharma, the most revered or honored. Here's way to become free from delusion. And delusion here is more literally like desire. So I take refuge in Dharma, most honored as free from desire, you could say. The Dharma itself is free from desire and delusion, but it's also the way to be free from the suffering that comes from delusion and craving for what we don't have, you could say. And I take refuge in Sangha, the most revered assembly. So they follow the most revered or the honored amongst two-legged, amongst teachings to become free from delusion, and amongst assemblies or communities. And then I have taken refuge in Buddha, or we say, now I have completely taken refuge in Buddha, in Dharma and Sangha. So our present ordination ceremony is a little bit like playing with this kind of list. You just list them once, then you define them briefly with a couple words, and then you say, now I have completely. And then Dogen says, initiate this vow, aspiring for enlightenment, the fruit of Buddhahood. Even though your body, mind, is born and dies moment by moment, your Dharma body surely grows and attains enlightenment. It's implying that this refuge is maybe goes beyond this limited life span of this body and mind takes refuge in Buddha, but our Dharma body, you could say our Buddha nature is evolving into the Dharma body, and this keeps growing and evolving towards complete Dharma body, even though this body and mind continues to die and be born. So it's just a whole piece of that Dogen's referring to, the three treasures. But I think let's keep going because there's some good stuff coming down here. Dogen says, taking refuge in, and that's this term in Japanese, kie, means returning and relying upon. So, and I think he just defines them instead of the other words, but kie means returning and relying, and that's what it actually means. Ki means to return, and e means to rely. Another translation says this kie, or returning and relying, means devotion and submission. Someone translated it that way. And then Dogen's defining these. Now, returning is like the key of kie. Returning is like children returning to their parents. Or another translator says, this returning is like children throwing themselves into their parents' arms. And it's a nice image, right, of thinking of taking refuge in Buddha in this way, like the way a child with total trust and even like abandonment and love, right, throws themselves into their parents' arms. That's like how we can take refuge in Buddha. That's returning. Something about maybe the loving trust, something like that. Even like without any question, throwing oneself into a parent's arms. Yes.
What's Dogen's understanding of Buddha?
Well, there's many, but let's wait until we get down to the bottom of the page where there's these four versions of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and each one is defined so in multiple ways. So just hold off on it. We'll get to this soon. It would be nice to do that first, right? To know what we're talking about refuge in. But here we're getting into refuge before defining them completely. So returning to is like that. Relying upon is like citizens relying on the king. So this is similar, I think, to a child jumping into their parents' arms. It also has this sense of trusting. It's a little bit more reserved, maybe, and a little bit more reasoned. Maybe the citizens have to like to really rely and trust their government leader. They have to like see that they're actually not corrupt to trust them. Or rely on them, but they rely on a virtuous leader because that leader actually helps them and protects them like a Buddha, like the Buddha, like true awakening protects. So
should we think of like Martin Luther King or something?
Yeah, maybe.
I can't really think of any government figure that I like want to.
That's true.
Or offers security.
Yeah, offer security. Mm-hmm. And maybe in a way we trust. I just mentioned this to Shoh before. Like, what do you think the difference is between these is like? Well, it's kind of like if you're paying taxes, you hopefully can trust that they actually go to rebuild the roads and the hospitals and the police and so on. Like, there's some we rely on the government in that way to help support us. And again, if it's not too corrupt, it does hopefully. And let's see. So that's returning and relying on. This phrase implies that you're liberated by doing so. You take refuge in Buddha because he or it is the great master or great teacher. You take refuge in Dharma because it is good medicine. You take refuge in Sangha because it's an excellent friend or excellent friends. So this is one of the many images for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The perfect teacher, the perfect medicine, and the perfect friends or companions on the path. It's a nice way of talking about Sangha. And then Dogen says, commentary called The Meaning of the Mahayana, some obscure Chinese text says, why do you return exclusively to the three treasures? The reason why these three are the ultimate place of refuge or return is that they help sentient beings to become free from birth and death and realize great enlightenment, or bodhi. So all three treasures help us to become free from birth and death is the Chinese way of translating the Sanskrit word samsara. Samsara is the cycle of birth and death. So the three treasures help us be free from samsara and realize great bodhi, or confirm, verify great awakening. These three treasures have a wondrous power, or merit and virtue. Buddha is a word from India. It's translated as awakened one in China. And it means one who has unsurpassed complete enlightenment or awakening, is this term kaku in Chinese, that literally means, even outside of the Buddhist context, it means awake or awakening, like awakening from sleep. So so that's a nice way of there's many Chinese characters that are used to translate Buddha, but I think this is one of the nice ones. It can also translate it as realization sometimes and enlightenment, but awakened, kaku, literally awakened. And that is the meaning of the Sanskrit term Buddha also. Dharma is a word in Sanskrit from India. It's also called Dhamma in Pali. Interesting that even Dogen includes the Sanskrit and the Pali, because Buddha and Sangha are the same in Sanskrit and Pali. Dharma and Dhamma are a little different, right? There are a variety of Indian sounds for it, Dogen says. In China, it's translated as law, although everything that is wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral is also, I would say, a Dharma here. The Dharma in which we take refuge is the Dharma that's the law. And this is referring to, you know, Dharma, we talked about last week, small d Dharma is like phenomena, right? All Dharmas are marked by emptiness. All things or phenomena or experiences is one meaning of the term Dharma. But that's the kind of Dharma that there's wholesome Dharmas and unwholesome Dharmas, mental phenomena. But he's like, that's not where we take refuge in. We take refuge in this capital D Dharma, the law, which is the literal meaning of the Chinese character Ho or Fa in Chinese. Law, like we could say law in this case means like truth, the truth, the unalterable law of reality, I would say. And Sangha is a word from India. It's translated as harmonious assembly or harmonious community in China. these three treasures have been venerated in this way. So this is a little bit like, this is a very different style from like the Genjo Koan or something of Dogen, right? It's like he's really writing almost like a little like manual, kind of, it's a little bit more like just defining terms in this very practical way.
Now, unfinished.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it might have even been his notes, right? For like, I'm going to really start riffing on all these ideas, but I'm just collecting them first. And then he never got to really take off with it. Yeah.
Because, on the different versions of three treasures, you know, how much of the importance is there, like, not like the one body, three treasures?
Well, that's what we're about to get into now. Yeah, this is, I think, a really deep, in a way, I think this next paragraph is, I think is the most interesting part of the whole essay, actually. And I don't know if it comes, I think some commentaries say it might come from some sutra, but nobody's traced it, but or it might be Dogen himself, or it might be some Zen teaching. And in the Kyoju Kaimon of Dogen that we sometimes recite on like full moon precept renewal ceremonies, it also has this list of different types of three treasures, but it's almost the same, but it's also different, and there's three types, so maybe we can look at that after this. But this is four different versions of three treasures, and it's just a nice, to answer Rachel's question, it's really like this all-inclusive, like, way of looking at Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and these, from different angles. And they're all, none of them are like, you could say, better than any other, I don't think. It's just the full expanded version of them. So, and, well, I would say the order of these four here seems to be from the most, like, conventional to the most ultimate. Or the most, like, kind of, we could also say, the most outer to the most inner. So the most outer conventional one is called, here it says, the three treasures that have been maintained. And it's in Japanese, Juji Sambo. Juji is abiding and maintaining triple treasure, or three treasures, Sambo. And,
Is that different than embracing sustaining?
Yeah, it's a little different. Abide and maintain. Judy is a pretty literal translation. Abiding and maintaining. Okay. Just as a random footnote, I don't think it's really related to this, but that's one of the words for the abbot of a Zen temple. There's various names like Hojo and Docho, and but one of them is the Juji. So it's the abiding and maintaining. The abider and maintainer is a name for the abbot of a Zen temple. So one translator calls this the eternal triple treasure. I think that's a big stretch, but I think it's maybe because they're maintained for eternity in this way. And Suzuki Roshi calls them the cultural three treasures. And I thought that's kind of interesting too. First, if we see what they are now, these three are defined as the Buddha treasure, such as Buddha images and stupas. So that's like statues and paintings of Buddha, that kind of images, and stupas. We had a discussion recently, like, there aren't stupas in Soto Zen, right? But actually, here's Dogen saying, stupa is a Buddha, actually, that you take refuge in the Buddha called a stupa. You know stupas? They're like, you know, memorial or, you know, mounds originally that held Buddha's relics, but then over time it became more like just a representation of Buddha. It's Buddha, actually Buddha mind, really, even when they sometimes talk about the body, speech, and mind of Buddha. It's like the body, the representation of the body of Buddha is like the images of statues and paintings, and the speech of Buddha is the written, the sutras, and the mind of Buddha is this formless stupa. It doesn't look like anything. It's just a...
But I've even heard the utmost point of a stupa is akin to the top knot.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sometimes matched up with places of Buddha's body, and also five elements, like earth, wind, fire, water, and space, are sometimes arranged by different shapes. So there's a lot of kind of symbolic imagery in stupas, but they're almost like the inner, like, non-physical being of Buddha, we might say. But here it's like, These things, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha's long gone, but there's these things in the world that still, like, remind us of Buddha. I think that's how we could see it, too. That's what images and stupas are in this abiding and maintaining triple treasure. The Dharma treasure transmitted as scripture on red or yellow scrolls. And which is just the way that I think it was the common way that sutras were preserved on yellow paper with these red bars, scroll bars on there. And then Sangha treasure, it says of precepts, but actually later it has precepts. I would take that out and say the Sangha treasure, including shaving the head, wearing a dyed robe, and following the precepts and Dharma procedures. So that's like, so now Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are these, really we could say like outer forms in this case. And so cultural, Suzuki Yoshi's cultural three treasures are like, if you just have those without the understanding or meaning of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, it's maybe kind of missing the point. But in fact, there are these outer representations that are cultural in the sense that they're part of like Buddhist culture, right? To express these kind of inconceivable realities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in some tangible form. And it seems that this is always... Since shortly after the Buddha's time, this is how this was a way to have the three treasures continue to abide and be maintained in the world in this kind of external way. And you could say it's kind of superficial, but in fact, we could say that's actually called three treasures. We can take refuge in Buddha images and stupas, take refuge in the actual written sutras, and take refuge in. This is implying like monks who maintain the Sangha by doing these traditional practices from 2,500 years ago. They shave the head and they put on a dyed robe and then they keep the precepts and Dharma procedures. You could say the forms, right? The forms and ceremonies of practice get maintained as the kind of outer body of Buddha.
And they're containers for our devotion.
Yeah, they're containers or expressions.
Expression like.
Yeah, a robe, and then you can the robe. It's a symbol, you could say. So we might even call it the symbolic three treasures. Maybe that would be another way to translate this. And yet the symbols are not just like totally extra. Some people might say that they are, right? And there are Buddhist groups who, like, we don't need these symbols anymore. I know there's at least a few Zen groups in America who, we don't want a Buddha image on the altar. That's like, old school. Let's use a stone instead. A beautiful, natural stone to represent, to symbolize the unformed, natural Buddha mind. Something like that. But also solid and stable. Stone's pretty good.
In Catherine Roshi, if I understand correctly, chose a stone at Monterey Bay Zen Center because it wasn't a temple. Obviously, there's a traditional altar here and was while she was abbot, but in Monterey, it was a stone that was chosen, as opposed to, but only because it was, I believe, because it wasn't a temple.
Yeah. No. Did she ever talk about that down there?
I recall a discussion about the stone. I can't recall exactly, but I associate her with the stone.
Mm-hmm.
And the stone came from Tassajara.
Mm-hmm.
So even before we remodeled and got this altar, we had a Buddha figure on the altar here. And then when this altar was built at the time of the remodel, we went on lots of shopping trips to try to find kind of the perfect Buddha image. And Catherine and I went to several like Asian antique stores in San Francisco. And then I don't know if it was offered freely or Catherine just started asking San Francisco Zen Center about, are there any Buddhas that you have in closets here, you know, that you're not using, that we might look at? And Paul Howler, I think, if that was a response from, or a request from Catherine, Paul Howler loaned this one, which was in storage. Yeah, so it came from something that Baker Roshi, you know, had lots of gifts given to him. And Baker Roshi also was quite a purveyor of the arts.
Yeah, collector of Buddhas.
Yeah. So we don't know whether this is a loan or not, but
San Francisco's probably forgotten that we have it. We also say like this kind of symbolic or cultural or abiding and maintaining triple treasure is almost like the traces or like leftover scent from when the Buddha was living in the world. So you could say if the Buddha leaves any traces, it's like, well, these images that we imagine look like the Buddha remind us of the living person of the Buddha, and the Buddha's speech is gone, Shakyamuni Buddha's speech, but the traces are left in these written sutras that are his recorded words, and the sangha of the Buddha's original followers from his time is gone, but the forms and practices of shaving the head and wearing the robe are still the traces. That's the scent, the aroma, you know, continues to be maintained for so many thousands of years, or so many countries. It's kind of amazing. And that these three are listed, you could say there's lots of other cultural forms, right? It gets so detailed, and there's divergence throughout, Thailand and Burma and China and Japan and Tibet, and there's different expressions. But these are nice because actually I think all Buddhist countries, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, they're all honor Buddha images, paintings and statues, and stupas are in the Theravada as well as Mahayana, and they all honor the Buddhist sutras, and they all have this form of shaving the head and putting on robes. So with all the different divergence of traditions.
Did the Buddha say something about not creating images? Just footprints for a while?
Yeah, there's that story, and I think I don't know if it's actually in the sutras, but there's that, I have heard this story too, yeah. that I don't know whether the Buddha said, or it was just the custom after the Buddha died, let's not limit the Buddha's Dharma body to this form body, which that wasn't really what he was about. So yeah, there were footprints, and there were like tree, like the Bodhi tree that the Buddha sits under, but nobody there.
And that still is the Bodhi tree.
Yeah, as a kind of symbol for Buddha.
Yeah.
But footprints is a nice image, because we could even say that these cultural triple treasure is like the footprints left from the ancient Buddha Dharma and Sangha. Mm-hmm. Like images are kind of like footprints, sutras are like footprints, mm-hmm. and the forms for practitioners are kind of like footprints.
And the same thing is true with the prophet. He basically said, for the Muhammad faith, the Islamic faith,
And that stuck. Nobody ever did make images of it. But the Buddhists couldn't resist it. Yeah. And I think it's because we are people. And so we relate to other people.
Yeah.
So if you just have like a footprint, it's hard to feel this like warm-hearted devotion to a footprint. Maybe even a stupa, right? But if it's something that's actually a beautiful image of a very serene person sitting serenely, and a nice Buddha image, I think when looking for Buddha images, we should look carefully and like, are they inspiring?
Yeah.
Do they make us actually feel calm and present?
Yeah.
Is there some inspiration that comes from the artist's skill to create that image? Yeah. Does that convey a compassionate energy at seeing that image of great compassion? And sometimes there's like they're, you know, wrathful, fiery, like Fudo in Japan is surrounded by flames. It has kind of like fangs. And it's like that's conveying some kind of fierceness. Fudo means like immovable, unshakable or immovable. So this kind of like, nothing will shake me off my seat. And yeah, it conveys that. That's the first, we could say, most outer forms of triple treasure, but we take refuge in them. The next is the three treasures that function as teaching. Again, that's a very vague translation. This is Keigi Sambo. Ke is like transform or convert or influence. Maybe transform is a good one. It's also used for Nirmana Kaya in Chinese, is like we say transformation body, and they use this character. Keishin is like the transformation body is Nirmana Kaya. So we might also say like manifestation body, but we ought to use that, right? Abiding and maintaining. But you could say these are manifestations or transformations. That's the K, and the gi here is like ceremonies or manners. So together maybe we could say like the transforming manners, or the transforming, maybe transforming manners, triple treasure as a kind of literal thing. That's maybe a little awkward. But in this case, the Buddha treasure is Shakyamuni Buddha, the world-honored one. So in our kalpa, right, in our eon, Shakyamuni Buddha is the supreme Nirmanakaya Buddha. And there won't be another one until Maitreya Buddha in the next eon. So he's our Buddha, Shakyamuni. There's other Buddhas, like Amitabha and so on, right? But Shakyamuni is like the founder of, in this era. There'll be other founders in future eras.
Which one's the Sambhogakaya?
Oh, yeah, when like the meal chant and so on. So then we say, the Dharmakaya is Vairochana. Mm-hmm. It's like the kind of cosmic Buddha, the great illuminator Buddha. And Lochana is the Sambhogakaya Buddha in that version.
Is that the five types of Dharma body?
Well, no, that's a little bit different, but yeah. So in this case, Shakyamuni Buddhas, you could say that it may be related to the Nirmanakaya here, right? The transformation body. So the transformation manner triple treasure is Shakyamuni Buddha. It's the Buddha, the Dharma treasure transmitted as the turning of the Dharma wheel. Shakyamuni Buddhas setting in motion the wheel of Dharma teaching, particularly his Dharma wheel, multiple Dharma wheels, the spreading of the sacred teaching, and the Sangha treasure of the five monks who listened to the Buddha's first discourse, including Ajñāta Kaundinya. So referring to that sutra that we chant on Friday mornings here, called Setting in Motion the Wheel of Dharma, supposedly the Buddha's very first teaching, and at the end, it says the five monks that he was teaching were glad and they rejoiced at his words. And then the sutra goes on from there, but we ran out of paper in our sutra book. So, I think the next sentence is, the five monks were glad and they rejoiced at his words. At this very moment, Ajñāta Kaundinya, who's one of the five, realized the spotless Dharma eye, and which is a way of saying, like, his Dharma eye opened. He understood the Buddha's teaching. They all rejoiced. Cool teaching, Buddha, but Ajñāta Kaundinya is like, you guys, this is more than cool. This is like, I just like now see reality. And it came in the version of these Four Noble Truths, interestingly, because you could say, it's so obvious, isn't it? But he deeply understood these Four Noble Truths.
So is that the point where the second turning of the wheel begins?
Well, this is still, I think it's actually, technically, they say when Ajñāta Kaundinya, our Dharma eye opened, that's actually when the Dharma wheel turned. You could say the Buddha could like spout out all these teachings, but if nobody ever gets it, the Dharma wheel, you could say, is not really turning. But when one person gets the teaching and is like free, at least to some extent, that now the wheel's turning. So that's still all part of the first. And then the Prajnaparamita Sutras, as the Mahayana teachings of all phenomena are marked by emptiness. That's the second turning of the Dharma wheel. And then the third turning of the Dharma wheel is a further elaboration on this second turning, including a kind of positive twist, no pun intended, positive twist spin of the Dharma wheel. It's like the Buddha nature teachings, you could say. And maybe that the Sandinirmocana Sutra is the first place to use this term of third turning of the Dharma wheel. Buddha taught in these three turnings. And that sutra doesn't actually literally mention Buddha nature, interestingly, but it's kind of a background for those teachings. So it's almost like this is almost like maybe we could even call it a historical triple treasure. If the first one's the kind of present cultural triple treasure, this is like the historical triple treasure of our time. Shakyamuni Buddha and his turning the Dharma wheel and his sangha of monks and Ajñāta Kaundinya is the first one to actually open the Dharma eye. It doesn't mean that he became a Buddha or even an Arhat, according to the sutras, but he entered the stream of Dharma. And then the Buddha kept teaching other sutras, and a few days later, I think, he realized his final fruition of Arhatship. And then the other ones got it, and then the rest is history.
Did Suzuki Roshi did he call this definition by a name?
Well, it's, you know, when he, in his comments on this, I think we were looking at the same talk of Suzuki Roshi. He's, I think, referring to this, not this essay, but this other one called the Kyoju Kaimon, the essay on teaching and conferring the precepts, in which there's three versions instead of four, and they're slightly different than this. So, although there is one that's called the Juji, the abiding and maintaining. But this one doesn't really have an equivalent exactly. It's the three are like a mix of these four. They don't correlate exactly. It's not in the Shogogenzo. It's a standalone essay attributed to Dogen, and I could bring a copy if you want for the next time. Yeah. It's just on two pages. It's also these. Dogen has a little verse on each of the 10 precepts.
Yeah,
it's, I don't know. It's online. It's not. It's not published, maybe. So that's the functional, or maybe another one we could say. The first one is like the outer forms in the present moment, and the second one is like the manifested three treasures in the Buddhas in ancient times. So you go from the present outer forms to the Buddhas, in a way, outer forms. These still look sort of like outer forms. We're talking about Shakyamuni Buddha, the person, the words that he spoke as the Dharma, and the and these five particular, like, five monks are the Sangha, very, like, you know, the outer manifestations still, because we're going to go more and more inward here. So the third now is the three treasures that are the essence of reality. And this is, in Japanese, ritai. So ri is this word that means, like, principle. Principle or truth. And tai is like essence or body. So we could say the truth body, or the essence of reality. Three treasures, something like that. But that's what he says here, the essence of reality. That's pretty good, I think, in this case. Are the Buddha treasure of the five types of Dharma body. And so here, the these five types of divisions of Dharma body. Luckily, there was a footnote about this, because I had never heard this term. But then you can found that it is indeed... it's actually called, in Sanskrit, it's called the five skandhas, or like collections. And I think it's like playing with this idea that us sentient beings have five skandhas, right? We have our five heaps or collections means skandha. So, you know, form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are the five skandhas of all sentient beings. But Buddhas, they say, don't have those five skandhas, right? They're kind of, they're beyond the five skandhas. They might appear to us like five skandhas person, but actually from their point of view, they don't see that they have a form or a feeling, something like that. So then maybe somebody like the Buddha thought, well, or the Buddha asked, well, what are your five skandhas, Buddha? So here's Buddha's five skandhas. They're completely different than sentient beings. The Buddha's five skandhas are in Sanskrit, Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, Vimoksha, and Vimoksha Jnana Darshana. So you could say it's the Buddha's, you know, way of being is Sila, or virtue, precepts, ethical conduct. That's like one of the Buddha's skandhas. Maybe a little bit like the form skandha. Yes. They're more like, they're just different aspects of Dharma, really. So not exactly the paramitas. But Sila is precepts or ethical conduct or virtue. Samadhi is concentration or presence. Prajna is wisdom or knowing reality. And those three are often, like, again and again through all the vehicles of Buddhism. Sila, Samadhi, Prajna is like the entirety of the Buddha's path. Virtuous conduct, present, settling, concentration on what's happening, and then the wisdom that opens up from that presence.
That's what, they're the three pillars, isn't that what, who's the Rochester?
Kapler?
Isn't that
I don't know if he called it, if that's the three pillars in his book or not. I can't remember. But something like, yeah, the three bases of all-encompassing practices, all through the Pali Canon, the Buddha will summarize his teaching. What's your teaching? Sila, Samadhi, Prajna. But here there's five, so sometimes that list is expanded. I would say they go in order, too. You start with this foundation of virtue and taking care of not harming others in the world. Then from that settled place of virtue and non-regret, sometimes is said, then we can start settling really deeply in the present, develop the kind of concentration and relaxation and presence of samadhi. And then from that presence of samadhi, we can then investigate what's happening and realize this prajna or wisdom, knowing, understanding. And then the fourth is vimoksha, which means liberation. So you could say, well, prajna is already liberation, but it's making it more explicit. And I think this means liberation from suffering. It's not just wisdom for wisdom's sake, it's the wisdom that frees us from suffering. And then interestingly, there's this fifth added on of the knowledge and vision of liberation, or vimoksha jnana darshana. So say, even liberation is not enough. to make a full five skandhas of Buddha, there's this knowledge and wisdom of liberation. And jnana here, this word knowledge, is also, I've been translating as awareness, as opposed to vijnana, is like, you know, divided knowing, dualistic consciousness is vijnana. Non-dual awareness is jnana, but interestingly, it can be also translated as literally as knowing, but like we could say knowing without touching things, non-dual knowing. And vision, darshana, if you know this Hindu term, darshan means like, you know, seeing the guru face to face with your eyes is like receiving their blessings of the deity. So, but it literally means seeing. So like, the knowledge and vision of liberation. And always, like in that first sutra, the Buddha says, how does he say it? Now I can have claim to have realized the perfect awakening that is supreme in the world. It's not just like there's an inconceivable liberation that I don't know about. There's some kind of like, no, I know, this is total freedom now. It's without a doubt, it's unquestionable. And we might say, but that's just knowing something. But that's actually a jnana. It's a non-dual knowing of it. It's not knowing it as some object, like, oh, I'm now the Buddha awakened. It's a direct knowing. It's an awareness, actually. Jnana.
Yeah.
J-N-A-N-A.
So is that the same as like a concentration?
No, that's like jhana.
Jhana, okay.
Which in Sanskrit is actually D-H-Y-A-N-A.
Okay.
Jhana, which is what Zen, the word Zen came from. And it, but in Pali, jhana is J-H-A-N-A, which is very close to jnana. So jhana and jnana. They're close, but actually quite different meanings.
You think that's what Paul Howler means when he's always like, you have to be aware, you're aware when you're aware. I'm always like, what the hell is he talking about?
That sounds good.
You think that's some reference to like...
jnana. Jnana, the awareness that has no objects outside of itself, because it's all inclusive. It's knowing... It's a kind of cognitive knowing. That's why we call it awareness, but it's not a knowing of anything. But it just, this jnana is J-N-A-N-A. So it's actually the same root. Jna, J-N-A, is the same root as prajna,
yes,
which was one of the other skandhas here, right? Prajna is a skandha, but jnana, jnana vimoksha. Jnana darshana vimoksha. No, vimoksha jnana darshana is another skandha. So, and it's also the same, yeah, that jnā is in vijnana. So they all have to do with a kind of cognitive knowing. Vijnana is a knowing, but it's dualistic. It's divided with a vijnana. And then jnana is just a non-dual knowing or awareness. And prajna, I think pra means like complete, so like a kind of complete knowing. And if it's prajna paramita, like wisdom beyond wisdom, or the perfection of wisdom, I would actually say that that's the same as jnana. Prajna paramita is the same as awareness itself. But prajna without the paramita could also include just like... worldly wisdom, and knowing how things function in the world is a kind of prajna too. All related though. And related to the English G-N-A, like or GNO, like gnosis, and knowledge and knowing.
Prognosis,
yeah. So that's a Sanskrit image of same root there. So I thought that was actually a cool teaching, that the Buddha's five skandhas are virtue, which, and it strikes me now, kind of goes with the form skandha for, you know, for sentient beings. Our form skandha is our, like, body functioning in the world, but it's maybe sometimes unvirtuous and virtuous. But the Buddha's functioning body in the world is just called virtue. Mm-hmm. That's the Buddha's two bodies, always beneficent. So maybe we could even match them, all of them up with the five sentient skandhas, but you can do that as homework.
and this is maybe a little convoluted, but I'm also sensing a correlation with the Eightfold Path in that eight paths are divided, wisdom, virtue, or ethics, and meditation.
Yes. Yeah.
Which are sometimes called the three pillars. I think Kaplow's definition is a little different, because I wondered about that too, and I looked it up at one point, and he has a kind of a different take on.
I think he might have made up his three pillars, not traditional
they're
ones.
They're not exact. But the other correlation I wonder about is I read and understood that though we begin with the first noble path of wisdom, which is right view, that as you work your way through the eight, you come back to wisdom, and it's not the knowledge wisdom that you had initially, but because of your practice of the other paths, you've come back to a new awakened wisdom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. They you could say that cycle, the Eightfold Path is not exactly a beginning to end. It's more like circular, and they each keep feeding on each other and increasing each other. And the virtue increases too by deepening the wisdom.
And it's the Eightfold Path to liberation, which is the fifth one here.
Yep, right. So that's true that the Eightfold Path is sometimes correlated with these, particularly these three, virtue, concentration, and wisdom. And then the four and five, the liberation and the knowing of the liberation, are sort of like the culmination of the Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. They're not really included in it per se, but they, we even, like the incense offering verse in Soto Zen, it's not completely these five, but it's, you know, virtue. It's Sila Samadhi Vimoksha, actually. It skips Prajna and it leaps to the liberation for some reason. So there's these different formulations. Virtue, when I offer the incense, I'll say virtue, presence, liberation, incense. Like bright clouds pervading the universe, I offer to the boundless Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in the 10 directions, universally perfuming the realization of Nirvana. And I think the feeling there is like we're offering this like outer stick of fragrance, but actually what we're really intending to offer is our own virtue, presence, and liberation. That's the supreme offering. That's what the Buddha's like even more than incense.
Is that a dedication only for priests?
No, anybody could do that, yeah. It's just a traditional incense offering verse. It's nice, encouragement to practice.
I don't recall ever seeing it written or...
It's not... It's in the Soto Zen, Japanese Soto Zen Sutra book. And I think there's a version of it written on the Green Gulch wall next to the incense stand. Another slightly different translation, but that same verse.
Isn't there another shorter one? I remember you telling me something that you say.
Well, Catherine said, may the Dharma spread like smoke from incense.
Yes.
That was her verse. Mm-hmm. And I think she got that from Katagiri Roshi, she said. So that's what she said.
Yeah.
What was it again?
May the Dharma spread like smoke from incense.
And of course you can make up your own too. But it's nice, these verses, especially for things like that, I think are great because, especially if you do it a lot, offer incense a lot, it's easy to just do it like kind of rote, like I'm just going through the motions. But the verse is nice because it helps to remember, this is what I'm actually like offering my practice, you know, and what, or wishing for the Dharma to spread. Yeah, it's an intention. So that's it. That was it. I got to learn this list through the study of the five skandhas of Buddha. And they're called, in China, they're called bodies. So here it's the five types of Dharma body. But you could also say these are the five skandhas, not so much of Shakyamuni, the person, but of the Dharma, the true reality body of the Buddha is these five skandhas, we might say. So now this is like all the expanding this third type of three treasures, the essence of reality three treasures. The Buddha is these five skandhas, five types of Dharma body. The Dharma treasure of Nirvana that is beyond change. So the Dharma in this case is Nirvana, or cessation is the actual character that is... beyond change here is asamskrita, which means unconstructed. I think a more literal translation here is the unconstructed nirvana, or uncompounded nirvana, unmade. And I think it's interesting that they, from ancient times, they translated this Sanskrit term asamskrita, which means unconstructed, or the unconstructed Dharma is basically nirvana. All other Dharma, all other phenomena are constructed or dependently arisen, but nirvana is not. So it's one of Dharma, you know, nirvana and space are asamskrita Dharmas. But the way the Chinese translated that is, in Chinese we say wu wei, maybe you've heard this term wu wei, which literally means like, no, Wu, or in Japanese it's mu yi. It's the classic mu, which means no or without. And wei is, in this case, is like made or contrived, maybe. As a Taoist term, wu wei means like this kind of natural flow in the world, right? Maybe you've heard this. Wu wei as a Taoist term means like naturalness. Like you're just kind of going with things in an uncontrived way, and that's the way the Tao is this natural way of being. But it's interesting, and maybe not just coincidence, that the Chinese, that term was already around in Chinese as a Taoist term, they used it to translate asamskrita. Because it has this literal meaning of like unmade. But it's nice that they use that term, I think, because also it means this kind of like natural, uncontrived way of being, which is how nirvana is. Nirvana literally is unconstructed, because it doesn't come and go, it's not made. But it also, the way we could say the realization of nirvana, the way it functions in the world is in this kind of uncontrived, natural way.
And what are the texts we've studied in the last maybe couple of years, someone talked about Wu Wei.
Yeah, I remember bringing this up before.
Yeah, and we talked about it. Pardon?
Was it the third picture? The Sling Song?
Yeah, it's maybe in there.
Yeah.
I can't remember where we came across the term, but it shows up here and there. Yeah, you know, I think it was actually the at least in the in that commentary by Musung, because he talked about Taoism, right? So it did come up in our study.
Yeah.
Trust in mind.
Right.
It came up. Yeah. And probably Vimalakirti Sutra too. Yeah. So literally here, it's like the Dharma treasure of the unconstructed nirvana, or we could say the uncontrived natural nirvana, the wu-wei nirvana, and the Sangha treasure of the merit of learning what is beyond learning. And I think here it's referring to, again, this Indian teaching of the final realization, like an arhat or a Buddha, is their final path is called Ashiksha Marga. There's these five paths of practice. Like at first you're just the path of gathering the conditions for practice, the path of preparation, where you're learning to deepen the meditation, then the path of seeing, which is this, again, darshana marga, the path of direct vision or seeing in a new way, and then the path of cultivation, which is like you're now applying your vision to your nitty-gritty of your daily life, and familiarizing with this vision. And then the final path is the path called, literally, the path of no more learning, ashiksha, no learning. And I think it means that, like, you're finished. This is, in Zen we might say you're never finished, but in this, these early models, there's a path where you're actually, you're done. You've learned what had to be learned, you've integrated it completely. This is traditionally said to be over three kalpas. Not just a one lifetime thing. It takes eons to complete this project, and then you're a Buddha. So I think here they're talking about this incredible fruition of Sangha called learning beyond learning. At least it's the same translation for this Ashiksha, but we might say we might riff on it in another way and say the Sangha is like learning beyond learning, like wisdom beyond wisdom, you know. But it really says learning no learning in the Japanese. So that's the essence of reality. Now we're into kind of the form. These are, I think, all formless. These five skandhas of a Buddha are formless types of Dharma body. The nirvana beyond the uncompounded nirvana is formless, and this, you know, path of no more learning or beyond learning is formless sangha. They're like the inner depth. But then there's still one more triple treasure, the three treasures as one treasure. And this is Itai Sambo. So the last one was Ritai. It's the same Tai. So the last one was like the principal essence, or the truth essence, or reality essence, and here it's like the one essence, or the one-bodied, the single-bodied triple treasure, and it's literally one. So it's, I think this is like trying to become even, you know, that last one sounded kind of like the ultimate version of Buddha, but this is like, let's just say it's like now the one-bodied of reality, the final ultimate. And in this case, the Buddha treasure of fully realizing reality, the Dharma treasure of being pure and free of defilement. And here defilement, we could say duality, any sense of Buddha being like this or like that. And Sangha treasure of living in accord with reality, being harmonious and free from stagnation, here it says. I don't think I would have translated it like that. I looked up the characters, and it's more like, there's two. It's like free from something like possessions, and then the second one is free from, it could be sluggishness, which is where they got that, but also means obstruction, which I thought, I would maybe put it like that. Being harmonious and free from obstructions. That's the Sangha. Buddha is realizing reality. The Dharma is, we could say, is the reality, pure and free from any dualistic grasp. And the Sangha is living in accord with the reality of Dharma. Being harmonious, free from all obstructions that would block the reality. is the one body triple treasure. You must take refuge in these three treasures. Those unfortunate ones who lack virtue do not even hear the name of the three treasures. How can they take refuge in them? So maybe that answers Rachel's question of what's Buddha in a very like long-winded way. You could say this, now that we have four versions of Buddha, four versions of Dharma, and four versions of Sangha.
See, I was just going to ask again, because I don't quite...
Well, if we just take Buddha, we could say Buddha's the one on the altar, the statue on the altar.
Okay,
Buddha's
so, okay,
Shakyamuni Buddha.
Right, okay, so,
Buddha is the five skandhas of...
Okay. So Dogen, it's not Dogen having one concept of Buddha.
Yeah, it's four yeah, okay. Types. And in again, this other essay, the Kyogyu Kaimon, I think he says, we'll bring in, yeah, I won't read through it, but he calls it, there are three kinds of merit and virtue of the Triple Treasure. So you could say that about these four, too. What are these four? There are four kinds of merit and virtue of the three treasures. Yes. Yes.
The fourth one, you said they're kind of, or actually, especially if you consider the translations, it seems like you said they're more inward.
Yeah, outer to inner or conventional to ultimate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth one seems to me like more material, or it seems like the skillful means version, or like how it is. So it kind of doesn't seem to follow that for me. So I was wondering
skillful means.
It could be like a circle, like loop back to the...
If we say it's skillful means, then that is a nice culmination from more or less conventional, kind of warming up to the practice, realizing the ultimate. But in fact, in the Mahayana, realizing the ultimate is not really the culmination. The culmination is actually skillful means, or like how it applies.
But would you say that even? Or how
do you... How do you see it as skillful means?
Well, or skillful means are like how... To me it's like you start with something, okay, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and he gives the translations, and you say, okay, what is that? Then you get the stupas and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, well, what is that? And Shakyamuni Buddha, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
These like heaps, these dharma bodies. But then you get to the last one, and then to me it's more like, how do you be that?
Yeah, it does have a little that flavor. Yeah. Maybe less... Skillful means like to benefit beings, but more like how it's expressed in life, you might say, right?
Well, and harmony is here. Harmony is not being suggested as something that we acquire, but something that we do, right?
I mean, yeah.
That we learn to support and
yeah.
Or it's also about, this is now called the one treasure rather than the three treasures.
Mm-hmm. And one body.
You might think of the three treasures being rolled into kind of one true reality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also didn't get that, like how, if the three are one, how there's three different meanings, but...
Also, it has a kind of sense of, maybe what you're saying too is like a kind of confirmation. So we could say, really this, the last one, the Buddha treasure of fully realizing reality, it's that one of Dogen's favorite terms is show, which means like verify or confirm, is used there. So if the last was just like these five inconceivable skandhas of Buddha, this is actually confirming or verifying it, and the Dharma is kind of confirmed as free from defilement of dualistic thought, and the Sangha is actually according with reality as a kind of verification or confirmation of harmony, free from obstruction. So you could say it's the verified version of the third, which is just explaining the principle. Mm-hmm. And it's called principle, the principle of the triple treasure. And this is the one bodied instead of the principle body. So, you can look at those more and consider that evolution or that four types of merit and virtue. We dedicate the merit and virtue arising from our investigation of refuge and our taking refuge in the three treasures to all sentient beings everywhere. May their five skandhas open into the five skandhas of the Dharma body. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.